ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option. It's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, it was Martin Luther King Jr. who said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice."
But in a world where both morality and justice are often debated, can we say that's the case?
Today, we'll ask one of Australia's greatest minds, the Honourable Michael Kirby. I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Willie Darley. Let's go roaming.
Well, Waleed, I'm actually super curious about this conversation, in part because I want to know what you think about Michael Kirby. I imagine that when you were a young lawyer in training, he might have been a name, a person that was mentioned a fair bit in your university lectures.
Oh, the great dissenter of the High Court. Does he still hold the record for the most dissents? I think he does.
I'm trusting you with that data.
Yeah, you can imagine as a law student, Kirby judgments were frequently cited. They were frequently read. Justice Kirby became the hero for most law students, I think. And the thing you always noted about a Kirby judgment was, yes, it was a dissent. It was always brilliant. It was quite prepared to break new legal ground, which was why it was in a dissent very often, and incorporate things like international obligations. This is relevant, I suppose, for a show like this, isn't it? That it's incorporate Australia's international treaties and obligations as something that can be read into Australian law, things like that, which is not an approach that other High Court justices particularly liked. And I don't think it's won the day, but there's no doubt his contribution in the legal field has been immense. And it's that approach to things that I think means that he remains so engaged in so many aspects of the world and so many flashpoints, so many issues that the world throws up, because he's always just been that incurably curious. and he's sought the fight. He's gone and had it, not necessarily in an aggressive way, but he's run to the conflict, to the action, and sought to engage, which I think wherever you end up standing on his views and his judgments, I think you can only find admirable.
Listeners might be thinking, well, why are we talking to Justice Michael Kirby on global roaming? Obviously, we kind of have some sense of his impact on Australia and our legal system over time, but he has held an enormous number of international roles as well with the UN, for example. Mm. He was chair of the UN Commission of Inquiry into North Korea. He was also on the Secretary General's high-level panel on access to essential healthcare, amongst a range of other things. He's also been awarded medals globally. He's honorary professor at universities here and overseas. So his work, his legacy is not just an Australian one. It is a global one. But I think it's quite an interesting time to talk to him, in part because so many of the areas in his life that he's dedicated himself to are kind of in flux at the moment, whether it is LGBTQIA+ rights, whether it is dealing with HIV and AIDS. I think a lot of the progress that many believed had been made is looking a little less certain at this particular point in time, not to mention the fact that so many countries around the world are experiencing the rule of law, you know, being challenged, whether we're talking about America or other developed Western democracies where I suspect, you know, for most of my lifetime, I'm sure most of yours as well, Waleed, we might have concluded that, you know, the argument was kind of settled.
Well, we've seen a lot of arguments revived, haven't we? And I think it's fair to say that those arguments have been trending in an un-Kirby-like direction. Perhaps we'll put it that way. I can't wait to get into those sorts of issues with him. And is he still optimistic about so, because he does have that streak of optimism, I think, in his work. Does that remain? The aspect of his work that I think it'd be great to start with is his work on North Korea. I mean, this is not something that people necessarily associate Michael Kirby with, but to cast a glance in that direction, to detail what's going on there, to come up with approaches or at least engage with the various approaches that the world and certainly South Korea are taking in trying to figure out what to do about North Korea and the direction they're taking. I just think it's wonderful to have the opportunity to speak to someone like him about an issue like that, given he's been so engaged with it and he's such an important and familiar voice to so many Australians.
Well, he is approaching 90, and as I'm sure you'll agree, he is in absolutely fine form. Here he is now, Michael Kirby.
Hi, Judge. Welcome to the show. Great to have you along. Sorry, I know you don't like being called Judge now that you're no longer on the bench, but I can't help it. I feel like I've got no choice in the matter.
All the law students call me Justice Kirby, and I've just given up trying to correct them. So you can call me what you like.
I just find it... we might have had this conversation before, but I was a legal associate in the family court my first year out of university. And I still call the judge that I worked for judge. Very hard. It's like when you meet your high school teacher or something.
I never knew my high school teacher's first names.
That's the way it should be.
Yes. He was Mr. Gibbons, and Mr. Gibbons was the only one who gave me the cane.
Is that right?
Only one incident of the cane, and that was grossly unjust, and it coloured my life as a judge and made me a bit of a softy.
Is that right?
What was it for?
He was deputising for our regular teacher who'd had a motor car accident. He came into the room. He obviously was irritated to have to be teaching us. And he picked up my book and he said, "This book is light. You've been tearing pages out of it. Do you realise this is the king's property?" I said, but, because I'd spilt ink from the inkwell on the book. A minor matter, you know, and I was trying to have my book looking clean and pristine, but he wasn't impressed, and he said, "Come out, Kirby, put your hand up. Two are the best." And I can still feel that funny feeling on your fingers when you get a cane. But it was an unjust punishment, and it demonstrated that not all punishments were just or fair, and you've got to listen carefully in case the accused has got some point to make.
Well, in that spirit, I think I need to hear from Mr. Gibbons to see...
Mr. Gibbons has long since been gathered up.
It's an unexpected way for us to start this interview. There's so much that we want to talk to you about. You've had this enormous and distinguished career. I actually want to start with some of your international work. You've recently been back to South Korea, and it's over a decade since you chaired that commission of inquiry. I'm wondering if you can observe any change, even, you know, from the South Korean side.
Well, don't forget that in Korea there is a big division, a political division, about what to do about the great problem of North Korea. The conservative side want to denounce them, reveal their errors, and do all the things that the United Nations tells them to do. The radical side was much more inclined to embrace the sunshine policy and to try by persuasion, by encounters, by being kind and nice to get North Korea to join the rest of the world. I have to say, I wasn't fully appreciative of that when I went there, and the UN didn't really brief us on this very big political division in Korea, and therefore I didn't really get a lot of information when we were doing the inquiry. If I were doing it again today, I would certainly make extra efforts. We made efforts, but I would make extra efforts to hear the sunshine view. Because the truth of the matter is that all the sunshine in the world will not alter the position of North Korea, which is to defend the Kim family and their hegemony, and that is what they have continued to do. 25,000 troops have gone from North Korea to the Ukraine war on the Russian side. So it's not a good international citizen, and it is terrible to its own citizens.
It's interesting, though. I was in South Korea in 2024 for a far less noble purpose than you, I need to make clear. I was just interviewing some film stars. But one of the things I did pick up when I was there was this sense that there seems to be a generational divide in South Korea on the approach to North Korea, that even the very idea or the dream of unification doesn't seem to be generationally shared. It just doesn't seem to be as big a deal or something that even the younger generation seems to think about as much. That was obviously just a very kind of cursory impression that I got from being there. Does it bear out, though, in what you saw?
I thought the division was not so much age as political approach.
Right.
They had a great president in South Korea, Kim Dae-jung, and I actually met him in the High Court in Canberra. He came out on an official visit just before he was elected president, and he was a very admirable man. He'd twice walked to execution, but he was reprieved under American pressure. And he survived, he became president, he founded the Sunshine Policy. And I think that was a good idea to try to reason and help and get them to be more modern. Because if they could be more modern, North Korea, after all, have developed the atomic weapons. So they've got a lot of smart people there. And they and South Korea would together be a tremendously powerful combination. But they didn't really get any dividend for that attitude and that policy. And the left side of politics continues to hanker for it. And it ought to be tried, but it hasn't paid off. And therefore, you have to make a decision. Do you do nothing and just hope it goes away or hope it changes in itself? Or do you denounce it and call it to the attention of the world and call it above all to the attention of the people of South Korea and North Korea so that they know how out of line they are in their treatment of their citizens?
You're listening to Global Roaming with Hamish McDonald and me, Waleed Ali. We are speaking to the Honourable Michael Kirby, one of Australia's most brilliant legal minds.
What do you think it says about the international rules-based order that really nothing seems to shift the dial in terms of North Korea? Like, looking back on what your commission found, it was, I mean, the evidence was pretty horrific. All the things, all the worst fears, I guess, the world thought about what goes on inside of North Korea, people, you know, living on rodents, lizards, grass, and yet nothing the world has done in relation to North Korea, isolation, sanctions, trying to freeze them out of all sorts of scenarios, has done much at all.
In fairness, there have been a few tiny improvements. For example, they never allowed us in the Commission of Inquiry in. They'd never allowed the High Commissioner for Human Rights in. They didn't allow the United Nations generally in. But they did ultimately allow that there was a need to improve the way they dealt with disabled people. Pyongyang was to be the most magical city in the world. You couldn't have a person in a wheelchair in North Korea because that would deface the beauty of Pyongyang. But under the guidance of the UN Special Rapporteur on People with Disabilities, they did improve the way they were dealing with people with disabilities. And I believe that there are people with wheelchairs appearing, making cameo appearances in the streets of Pyongyang. But that's really a very small contribution of human rights to their way of life. The fundamental rule is the Kim family and their defence of their status and of their power. And Trump said he would change things. And at the time, I thought, and I said, that I thought it was worth giving it a try. But he approached the matter when he had his first meeting, which was in Singapore, and then the second one in Hanoi, going straight to the centre of the dialogue, which was nuclear weapons. And in fact, a diplomat would have told him, you start at the outside of the circle. You start with meeting of sports people and games and shared interests in language and culture. And you reach nuclear weapons at the end of the dialogues. But that was not Mr. Trump's approach, and therefore it didn't really pay off anything.
If it's the case that very little seems to be working, that you can approach it this way, you can approach it that way, but ultimately North Korea seems not to be for shifting. To what extent do the South Koreans have, I don't know if the right word is luxury, but, you know, the option of just saying, well, all we can really do is leave North Korea to its own devices and move on more or less as though it doesn't exist. I understand there are generations back families that are either side of the border, and there are questions like that. But as time goes on, those questions would have to be more at the margins, I would have thought, of South Korean society. Do you detect an attitude within South Korea that maybe the whole issue of North Korea is less urgent than it was?
Not so much less urgent, but that the strategy of denouncing and revealing and describing is not going to get anywhere, and therefore other strategies should be tried, like foreign assistance and support, and maybe some cultural connections. But none of that has worked. And there is something that's been injected into the mix since the Commission of Inquiry was there, and that is the nuclear weapons. They now have developed nuclear weapons in North Korea. South Korea doesn't have them, but they have got these, and it makes them a member, effectively, of the nuclear weapons states. That's a bit of a worry, because that means that everyone who's watching in South Korea knows that they have a weapon that can obliterate them. And that, I think, increases the alert and the concern and the vigilance and the hostility. And that is what still exists in North Korea from everything we hear. And the government in the South seems to think that it can just go on with dialogue and discussion, and they've brought proceedings in the courts to stop people in South Korea trying to send radio signals and give information on what is happening in their own country. So you couldn't have Radio National in North Korea, I'm afraid. It's Radio Kim, and that would be what they think is right. That's what Kim thinks is right.
You've served on various international bodies, UN bodies. Do you think there's much of a role for this sort of activity in Trump's world?
Well, don't forget that Mr. Trump has to face the electors. At least it appears that he will not have a right to a third term. He may have a legal argument, which we'll ultimately hear, whether the ban on a second term is a ban on two consecutive terms, as distinct from a ban on the absolute number three. But one way or the other, he's going to be rendered accountable to the people.
Can you imagine him making an argument, a plausible argument, about a second non-consecutive term?
Well, he makes so many arguments that every now and again he's bound to have one which gathers the support of a majority of the Supreme Court. And he's had a few wins in the Supreme Court, and who knows? After all, we can elect our Prime Minister over and over and over again, and that did happen when Mr. Menzies laid down his position, and later when Mr. Howard was elected. They had very long terms, so it's not an irrational idea. It'll come down to the language of the US Constitution, and that'll be decided by people who know a lot more about it and its history than I do.
I'm just trying to imagine, though, what the political side of this equation as regards North Korea might be. I mean, you've got Donald Trump having intervened in Iran in a war that is deeply unpopular and in which he seems to be stuck. The idea that he would turn his gaze towards North Korea and try to come up with some kind of intervention when, I mean, military intervention's off the table, you would have thought, given what's happened in Iran and given that North Korea has nuclear weapons and given that no other political approach seems to have worked, and given his lack of long-term focus on such things that he's evidenced while in office, whether or not he faces the people again and however accountable he might be, do you really see that it would make any difference on an issue like North Korea?
On an issue like North Korea, I'm not so sure, but on politics generally, it's not just Trump who has to get a next term. It's also Vance or whoever comes into the succession. But we'll see this in due course. I think Trump will pursue every possibility to hang on to office. And the word that is going around the traps is that there will be some sort of national crisis which will result in a cancellation of the midterm elections. Or I don't see that happening, because the United States remains fundamentally a rule of law constitution. But Mr. Trump is so exceptional and so different from everyone who went before. George Bush was a hero in South Korea, George W. Bush, because he stood up for the people of North Korea, and he said it was not just a matter of governments and politics, it was people. I went down to Texas and I met George W. Bush, and he still had a commitment to the rights of the people of North Korea to know what's going on in their country. The rules-based order may be under threat, but it's still there, and I have a conviction that we've got to do something about improving the situation and bring it to the notice of the people of North Korea who have a right to know about it.
I can't go past the fact that you said you went down to the ranch in Texas to visit George W. Bush.
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, he was very, very nice. He put his arm around me and he took me into his dialogue. It wasn't a one-to-one meeting. There were others who had been involved in the Commission of Inquiry. And he was really very strong on the rights of the people of North Korea to be liberated from this horrible government that they have. And it is a very curious thing that so many years after the Kims were put into power in 1945, that they're still there. Many of the academics and other experts commenting on it, when I came to the COI, they said, if this regime is gone in 20 years, I will not be surprised. If this regime is gone in 20 years, I will be surprised. So it's still there, and it's now flexing its nuclear muscles, and it's sending 25,000 troops to help the Russian Federation, which seems to need them. And so it's got grandiose ideas about its importance, something that tends to happen when you get a nuclear weapon.
Well, that was the Honourable Michael Kirby. Not to be called judge any longer.
It's going to happen. I'm going to keep doing it. I will.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about North Korea, because there's a whole other part of this conversation still to come. By the way,
yes.
Look out for the next episode in your podcast feed. There's just so much to talk to him about, but I do think it's worth us spending a moment on the North Korea stuff, because he has a genuinely unique perspective on this. I was rather intrigued that he had so little preparation on the Sunshine Policy part of South Korea's approach to North Korea before doing that work. Because to me, that has shaped so much of what has happened, you know, just on that side of the border over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, that is intriguing, isn't it? I wonder what that reflects, whether it has to do with a particular institutional view. But I think also, whether he's forewarned or not about that, The description he gives, I found it really instructive, because it shows the way in which there seem to be no good options. You can have your preference, you can have the flavours that you're going for, but if what you're looking for is something that is more muscular than the sunshine option, for example, well, I still don't really know what form that is meant to take.
Mm.
Maybe this is just speculation on my part. I think the reason that you have a superpower like the United States joining forces with Israel prepared to attack Iran is that they don't have nuclear weapons. There's no prospect that they would do anything like that in the context of North Korea. And frankly, we can see how badly it might go if they do, given what we've seen happening in Iran, that these things don't necessarily work. I know Justice Kirby's position on just about everything is, well, you can't just sit there and wring your hands about it. You've got to do something. But beyond that attitudinal approach, that disposition, Do you leave with optimism from this, Hamish, that there's any kind of genuine response or program?
My sense is that globally there's a degree of fatalism about North Korea right now, particularly because of the relationship with China and the fact that Kim has been able to also leverage a relationship with Russia because of the Ukraine war. You know, it's only been in recent weeks that we've seen, you know, vision of more North Korean soldiers sent there. So Kim has managed to deal himself back into, I guess, the global geopolitical game, despite the fact that there's been these decades of attempts at isolation. So there's that piece of this. But just to the point about, you know, the waxing and waning of policy within South Korea and, you know, from the Americans, I think what I only really understood when I started covering the Korea story, if you like, A, is the physical proximity, but B, the emotional proximity.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking about Israel and Gaza here, where although physically proximate, two very different peoples and cultures and belief systems and, you know, family structures, basically, like people literally don't know each other and view each other as entirely different. When it comes to Korea, you know, the people that are living up near the border areas in South Korea have family, or at least believe they still have family over the other side. There are these connections, these ties that continue to exist. There are people whose hearts are broken, you know, wanting, hoping to at least find out if their loved one is still alive. And so I think sometimes the binary of the way in which we describe North Korea, because clearly Kim and the Kim dynasty have done some terrible things, but it slightly neglects the reality that for so many people in South Korea, there's a much more human link.
In some ways, it's definitely not a perfect correlation, but it reminds me a little bit more of the India-Pakistan thing, where you have, even in that case, you have with partition families happening on opposite. I mean, it hasn't resulted in harmony in that case, no. Either, for all the differences. That is an important part of it to keep in mind. But it does stand to reason, doesn't it, that even those links between peoples, that sort of idea of a unified people, unified culture, families on opposite sides of the border and so on, that can only last so long, right? That there has to come a point where they become the traces of mythology or memory, and they don't become the experience or the condition of people's hearts in the given moment. There aren't that many people that can even name their great-grandparents, are there? So these things can go pretty quickly within generations. And then at that point, what happens in the whole grammar of the relationship between the two? Do they become effectively distinct and separate peoples and separate nations? Does unification become something that's largely irrelevant? Does it just become a question purely of military survival and, you know, well, as long as they're not bombing us, things are okay? So many things to play out here. And while our attention is focused on the Middle East, this whole sphere, this whole theatre just seems to be kind of forgotten, I guess because it's the last remnant of the Cold War, isn't it? And it remains cold.
Well, thankfully, there is more of our conversation with Michael Kirby to come in part two. Look out for that in your podcast feed. In the meantime, do get in touch with your feedback. global.roaming@abc.net.au is the email address. Thanks to producer Aston Brown, supervising producer Pat Sunderland, and executive producer Laura McAuliffe. Waleed, any highlights to look forward to in episode two?
Oh, you can't expect me to give things away, can you? But yes, I do like that I end up having, you know, conversation with Justice Kirby about the appropriateness and enduringness of Enlightenment philosophy. I mean, if there was one thing that was on my bingo card today, that was it. And finally, it's been ticked off.
So, I suspect the main tease for listeners is that he scolds both of us equally.
Oh, it does. He does not hold, in a polite, judicial sort of a way, but he does do it, doesn't he?
It happened. See you next time.
See ya.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listener.